What do you get when you have an energy that's so abundant, it becomes too cheap to meter? Well, you start using more of it, and then you start to do things that you never would have thought possible. The real fun begins. I'm Sean Kenny, and this is the Rock Logic Podcast. Everyone, and welcome to part three of the Thorium episode of the Rock Logic Podcast. I am very excited today because I get to talk about one of my favorite subjects. Now, of course, I've done nothing but that in the last two parts. But just as a quick recap, part one, we discussed thorium as this revolutionary fuel and why it's so awesome and amazing and wonderful. Part two, we talked about the molten salt reactor and why it's superior to why it's we currently have today. Part three, I'm going to be basically doing nothing but talking about what you can do. I'm going to be asking what happens when you take a perfectly good energy source and a really efficient energy technology and you mold them together. Well, you have energy that's so cheap that you can just use more of it. And when you use more energy, you tend to do things that you just wouldn't have used in other industrial processes. So today, just to put things in context, for those of you who don't know, we mainly use fossil fuels to produce the majority of the energy that we use. And though we can't admit that it has provided a standard of living in the Western world that we can all be proud of, unfortunately, it comes with a lot of negative side effects, pollutions, terrible emissions, ocean acidification, things of that nature. Currently, we're talking and having a conversation about using renewables, things like wind and solar. I personally have worked in the renewable sector, and I know for a fact that unfortunately, though there is a lot of promise to solar, you can't really run it or have it take over the entire economy without a significant increase in subsidies or an implementation of a carbon tax of some sort. And on top of that, it's incredibly intermittent. We live on a planet that rotates on its axis. We have to implement mass energy storage. So there's a lot of shortcomings when it comes to renewables. What's great about the molten salt reactor, and just to put up a scenario here, let's just assume for a moment that we have adopted the molten salt reactor and thorium as the energy source of the future. What happens to fossil fuels? What happens to renewables? Well, the funny thing about this, and one of the things that I love about this energy source so much, is not so much that it could replace everything like coal, like gas, like oil, like renewables, and just do the job perfectly without fail, but the fact of the matter is that it can both do that and act in synergy with these other energy sources. And I could just go down the list here in terms of how these energy sources can benefit from an economy and where we're running most of our energy from thorium, from molten salt reactors. And we'll start with coal. Coal gets a bad rap. It is the dirtiest fossil fuel known to man. People consider it to be this really bad thing. But the fact is coal isn't benign or maleficent. It just is. It just is what it is. And if I have any issues with the way that we use coal, it's the way we've been using it for the last 150 years. We just burn it in a furnace and we boil water to make steam. We spin a turbine, we generate electricity. But a lot of people don't realize that if you pair it with a molten salt reactor, you actually can do some really interesting things with it. So instead of generating electricity, why not make liquid fuels? Today, the amount of coal reserves in North America alone contain more chemical energy than that of all of the world's oil combined. That's Saudi Arabia, that's the US, Russia, everywhere. So just in North America alone, there's more coal, more chemical energy there in the form of coal than there is in all the world's oil reserves combined. Now, how do we use it? Well, as I mentioned in the last part, a molten salt reactor operates at extremely high temperatures. To put it into specifics, about 700 degrees centigrade. Now, that's considerably hot. And though you will be using it mostly to generate electricity through turbines and all that stuff, there's a considerable amount of waste heat that's left over. Because the amount of waste heat that's left over is so high and so significant, you can actually use that for all kinds of industrial processes that we've never considered before. So in the case of coal, we actually can do some chemical processing there to liquefy it and make liquid fuels. Now, when I say liquid fuels, I'm not talking about methanol or ethanol or dimethyl ether or biodiesel or anything like that. I'm talking about diesel, gasoline, and jet fuel that are more energy dense, much cleaner because they've been able to go through additional processing because, again, that waste energy is free, but they are chemically indistinguishable from their petroleum counterparts, meaning you could put it in your car, you could put it in a jet engine, you could put it in a diesel motor, and it'll act the same way that it does with a with any petroleum-based gasoline that you get at the pump. Actually, one could make the argument it would run a lot more environmentally benign. You know, most cars today, they have a catalytic converter that, you know, takes a lot of those emissions and prevents all kinds of, you know, really nasty stuff from getting into the air. Well, the way cold liquid fuels, you know, with their additional processing, you actually can burn up a lot of those energy molecules in the first pass through to the point where you don't even need a catalytic converter. And if you have one, it'll basically just act as a redundant. So you actually would be getting, you know, considerably less emissions, or at least less sulfur emissions and just less smog than you conventionally would in a regular internal combustion engine that runs on regular unleaded gasoline from a petroleum resource. And because the waste heat is free, from what I've heard from various other sources that have actually looked into it, you actually can come in at a price point that's 80% cheaper than conventional petroleum-based fuels, which, you know, I mean, if we went ham on, you know, coal to liquid fuels, I don't know how that would affect the petroleum industry, but domestically, at least, it'd be hard to compete with, because when you come at it 80%, you pretty much stay in the industry as long as your competitors want you to. So that's coal right there in a nutshell. Natural gas. We obviously can take coal and we can make liquid fuels. We can also make synthetic natural gas. We can also make synthetic natural gas from trash, from municipal solid waste. Again, the same principle applies here. When you have waste process heat at 600 degrees C, 700 degrees C, it's extremely hot. I mean, paper burns at 454 degrees Fahrenheit. So at 600 degrees C, you can do all kinds of really interesting stuff. And, you know, we could supplement the amount of natural gas that we mine naturally in this country with municipal solid waste, you know, converted into synthetic natural gas to run the power plants that are already in operation today. Why would we do this? Well, we have a considerable number of landfills in this country that are an eyesore, and you'd obviously just, we just don't want them around. So from a waste management standpoint, this actually helps us make a cleaner, healthier planet for us to live in, and does so in a fashion that makes it much more economically feasible. For the petroleum industry, you know, I've talked a lot about coal. If we decide not to go that way, that's fine. We have a considerable amount of heavy oil resources in this country are not as of yet economically feasible to tap. There's a lot of reasons for that, but one company out in Canada has actually been funded on the specific premise that they want to use the thermal profile of a molten salt reactor to make steam, which they can use for SAGD and advanced oil recovery, basically pumping pipes into the ground, heating those heavy oil reserves to make them much more easily extractable, and thus expanding the amount of heavy oil resources that can be recovered. You can also use a molten salt reactor to power a refinery, and you can, on top of powering it cleanly, as opposed to you just burning natural gas or oil, you could also produce much more efficient, much more energy dense petroleum-based fuels, you know, by advanced hydrocracking and various other, you know, methods. I won't go into this episode. But the fact is that at least within the fossil fuel industry alone, there are enough synergies here and where everyone can still be a player in this market. We don't have to go full ham on thorium molten salt reactors to the exclusion of everything else. Everyone will still have a role to play in this market. And that'll lead to some very positive things there. Solar and wind, you know, we talked about fossil fuels. Well, how does it relate with renewables? Well, specifically with solar and wind, They're very inefficient. Right now, we have very brilliant people, including the likes of Elon Musk, that say we need to build these giant factories in the desert that make lithium ion cell batteries, and we need to sell those batteries to consumers. And the idea is that everybody would have solar panels on their roof and batteries in their garages that would store the energy when you would need it. And you could use it at night when the sun is down and not generating electricity. And though in theory, that does, you know, that does make a lot of sense. On a large industrial scale, at least by today's standards, is not particularly economically feasible. And I will be touching that in later parts of this series. Excuse me. But on that note, we don't implement mass storage in this country. And in a lot of countries, they don't implement any sort of mass storage at all. In this country specifically, the way that we cover renewables at night when the sun is not shining or the wind's not blowing is we burn natural gas. And though it is an efficient way of doing that, unfortunately, it's not a long-term solution. It still emits pollution in this, you know, on the planet that we live in, and that's not a good thing. It also is not a long-term solution because right now natural gas is very cheap. If it ever became more expensive than it is today, we would not be generating electricity from renewables in the way that we're doing it. So how does a molten salt reactor come into play here? Well, one thing, and surprisingly, I didn't cover this in the last episode, was a molten salt reactor, because of the way it's designed, does a really good job of load following, meaning that you can actually generate power and decrease the amount of power output in such a way that it doesn't cause any strain for the grid. So at night, when there's less power demand, you can throttle the reactor back. During the day, when there's peak power, you can throttle the reactor up to generate power as needed. So if you have a market like California specifically, where there are actual government mandates in place in terms of a renewable energy portfolio standard, where a certain percentage of your electricity needs to be powered from renewables, you can still do that and have a means of providing backup power for the people who are using your power. So during the day, when you're generating a lot of wind, a lot of solar, you can generate electricity by those means. And when there's a lag in production output, you can just throttle up the power on your molten salt reactor to cover the load. Another great thing about thorium, and we're going to cover this in the next episode, is a lot of these renewables require things like neodymium for wind turbines. They require all kinds of materials to make batteries and various other things. They all come from rare earths. The thing that we touched about on part one is that wherever there are rare earths, there's thorium, and wherever there's thorium, there's rare earths. So when you go mining for rare earths, there's a chunk of thorium in the ground. When you're going through the process of making these wind turbines and solar, you're also mining thorium on the cheap, which will be accessible for these reactors. In terms of the existing nuclear energy industry, you know, it'll take some time before we start manufacturing these reactors in an assembly line and, you know, get into mass global industrial wide, you know, adaptation of this. But there's still a bunch of light water reactors in this country and on this planet that operate on those same principles. Well, what do we do with all the nuclear waste that's been left behind? Well, you will actually be able to, and there are several proposals to take existing stockpiles of spent nuclear fuel or nuclear waste and melting it down by a process of using molten salts. And you could actually use that to run in a molten salt reactor. I'll be touching base on this later on in the series, but that is a considerable advantage. Another thing, in case I didn't mention it before, because of how small these reactors are, you can build them much quicker, much more reliably in a factory setting. So the cost of the reactor would be considerably lower than the process to which we adopt nuclear today, which is extremely inefficient. So we've covered all the energy stuff. Is that it? No, absolutely not. There's considerably more things you can do. Again, 700 degrees centigrade. When you're operating at these temperatures, you can do some really crazy, insane industrial applications. In terms of the aluminum and steel industry, when you have, you know, cheap energy and excessive waste process heat, you can make bigger, better, high strength steel materials, you know, at cheaper costs. You could produce it at cheaper rates. In terms of aluminum, You know, and far as the United States is concerned, we don't have vast amounts of bauxite ore. We do, however, have a considerable amount of waste in coal ash tailings across the country. And those coal ash tailings have a number of other resources, such as aluminum oxide. When you have an energy source that's cheap enough to where it's economically feasible to extract it, you can take the aluminum oxide from these waste dumps, and you can use the aluminum for various things. If imagine a world in where aluminum becomes so abundant that it becomes, you know, much cheaper to make cars out of it. You have lighter weight cars, which in turn means more efficient electric vehicles, more efficient gas powered vehicles. So it's a win-win for everybody. Water, you know, I live here in California. We have a big problem here with droughts, and we have a big problem in terms of access to, you know, fresh water. One thing that was envisioned back in the 1960s by the original inventor was to live in a world in where we would have these power plants operating on coastal sites, and we'd be generating electricity all day, all night long, and the waste heat generated would be used to desalinate massive amounts of water. There are several processes to making desalinated water, but when energy cost doesn't come into play, you can use procedures that produce far less brine and have a lot less environmental waste as a result of it. So if you like clean drinking water and cheap, clean electricity, that's another fun thing. Medical isotopes, we kind of touch base on this. I have a little experience with this because I worked for a company that talked about medical isotopes, and I'll definitely cover this later on in the series. But we have a shortfall in terms of various medical isotopes that are needed in various diagnostic procedures in the country. We use molybdenum 99 for x-rays, for doing chest x-rays, for heart examinations and various other things. It's exceptionally rare. So one thing that's nice about a molten salt reactor, particularly one that uses thorium, is you actually can produce a lot of these materials in common usage to the point where they're just so cheap that they're readily accessible in every hospital around the country. Same goes for bismuth-213, which scientists have used in various experimental treatments in terms of targeted alpha therapy to cure various forms of dispersed cancers, which, you know, I mean, if we're living in a world where we cure cancer, or at least most of them, I'd say that's a good future to live in. And then going into the really crazy stuff and stuff that I haven't even touched in any of the episodes, thorium could be used in terms of space exploration. Right now, NASA, the way they do deep space exploration with their robotics program, specifically with the Mars Curiosity rover and things of that sort, is they have these machines. They're radioisotopic thermal generators that use plutonium-238 and the decay of said material to power said things. Why would you need that? Well, when you're going to places like Mars or in deep space like Saturn, where you don't have as much solar output, you need a very compact form of energy to generate electricity. With plutonium-238, you can do that, but as with the medical isotopes and some of the other stuff that we've talked about, plutonium-238 is exceptionally rare, and it's not in in common supplies. We've used most of our existing stockpiles, and we've bought some from the Russians, but we don't have a lot of it. In a liquid fluoride thorium reactor, like the one that is being proposed by FLIBE Energy, these guys are talking about producing this in accordance with various other things like bismuth, like moly 99. So this will be something that will be produced as a waste product of that reactor. So we would actually not only be able to help NASA's shortcomings, but as we see companies like Blue Origin and SpaceX go into places like the moon and Mars, it might be readily accessible for them to do science and other really cool stuff. And on top of that, you also, when you make smaller, more compact reactors that can fit inside of a, you know, jet airliner or a C-5 Galaxy airplane, you could probably get it small enough to where you can operate in space colonies. You know, right now, Elon Musk has a very ambitious goal over at SpaceX to develop colonies on places like Mars, where we would have a thriving civilization of 1 million people from Earth living on Mars for the rest of their days. You need energy in order to run their daily life. And, you know, though you could use solar, unfortunately, it doesn't work quite as well on Mars as it does on Earth. So you would need a nuclear energy supply. And that kind of just to wrap things up. I mean, honestly, I could go on all day about this, but those are just some of the applications that can be used in a world and where we have cheap and abundant energy that's readily accessible for the global population. That's our show for today. Next episode, we're going to be talking about rare earth elements and the manufacturing state of developing really high-end products in the economy and what needs to be done to bring jobs back home. This is us talking about thorium. I'm your host, Sean Kenny. This is Rock Logic.